Hi everyone, welcome to the Live Longer World podcast, where I have conversations with scientists, entrepreneurs, and other advocates that are transforming the field of longevity science and advancing the science behind slowing and reversing aging. I am your host, Aastha Jain. Besides this podcast, I also write a newsletter focused on longevity lifestyle hacks and have a YouTube where you will find the video version of this podcast and other podcast clips. You will find all these resources on my website. Head over to livelongerworld.com. All right, with that, let's jump into today's episode. My guest today is Dr. Matt Kaebelin. Dr. Matt Kaebelin is a professor of pathology, adjunct professor of genome sciences, and adjunct professor of oral health sciences at the University of Washington. His research focuses on basic mechanisms of aging in order to facilitate translational interventions that promote health span and improve the quality of your life. So Matt has been around the field of aging for a long time, and he knows more about the work in the field than perhaps anyone else. We had a very comprehensive conversation, and we spoke about how Matt thinks of aging from a functional perspective and touched upon quite a few different interventions, including caloric restriction, the role of sirtuins in aging, and also whether NAD plus precursors are effective in slowing aging. We also discussed quite a bit on rapamycin and how it's been shown to be effective in improving the health of mice. Matt is quite excited about the potential benefits of rapamycin in reversing aging, and he got me quite excited too. Matt's also working on the dog aging project, and we discuss his work around trying to understand the cause of aging in dogs. Finally, we end the conversation by talking a bit about what good scientific practices should look like. Matt approaches his work with an unbiased lens, and I think that's very respectable and commendable. I had such a blast talking to Matt, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did.
Well, hello, Matt, and welcome to the Live Longer World podcast. It's such a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm extremely excited for this conversation because I know you're one of the people who's been around the aging field very long and knows about a bunch of different things. So we're going to cover a lot of topics today, and I can't wait to learn a bunch from you.
Sure. Yeah, I laugh because it sounds like you just called me old.
No, well, I didn't call you old. No, that's not true. Well, I called you wise and informative.
I'm definitely getting there, right? But that's all right.
Great. So I think a good place to start would be, let's just talk about aging first. And I know recently you mentioned how when it comes to thinking about aging, you don't only think about it in terms of molecular mechanisms, but you've also started thinking about it from a functional decline perspective. Right. I'd love it if you could discuss a bit about how you think about aging and the functional decline piece of it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think both are important. And I think just to take a step back, you know, I think one of the things that often gets lost when we talk about aging is that different people define aging differently. And so, you know, you'll notice sometimes that there are these arguments or, you know, heated discussions about aging. And a lot of times what it boils down to are different definitions. And so I think it's really important that, you know, when we're having these discussions that we're clear about what we're talking about, right? So I've been studying the biology of aging, you know, for a long time now, as you suggested. And so that's kind of I immediately gravitate towards the biology, right? What is it that changes about the biology and the physiology of animals and people as we get older, right? Which is related to chronological aging, but not equivalent, right? This idea that different people age at different rates and our biological aging process, you know, may be accelerated or delayed in different individuals. So I think that's kind of the way I always think about aging. And even within the biology of aging, you know, as you suggested, you can think about it from the molecular perspective, the sort of hallmarks of aging perspective. What are the types of changes, damage that happens as we get older at the cellular molecular level? Then those are important to understand mechanisms of aging and to give us potential targets to go after with therapies and interventions. We need that molecular understanding so we can predict what we should be doing from an interventional perspective. But then once we have interventions, you know, in order to evaluate the efficacy of those interventions, we really need to start thinking about, in my view, functional measures of aging. So lifespan is great. Like lifespan is what we use in the laboratory to test whether a drug or a treatment is affecting aging. That's not pragmatic or practical in people, right? So we really need these functional measures of aging that we can evaluate whether the intervention is actually working. And so what I think of when I think about functional measures of aging, you know, some of them are the obvious stuff. How well is our immune system functioning? How well is our heart functioning? How well is our brain functioning, right? Some of those are easier to measure than others. But I think also there are functional measures, you know, just like pain, chronic inflammation, you know, tendinitis, right? That's a really good example. A lot of people suffer from tendinitis and it affects their daily life. That is not completely due to aging, but it's definitely age associated. You are at a greater risk of chronic inflammation and tendinitis as you get older. We can evaluate whether interventions affect those sorts of functional quality of life measures, but people don't think about that a lot. It seems like in this field, at least. I think geriatricians are more used to thinking about these functional measures, grip strength, walking speed, mm-hmm. things like that. We don't really think about that so much on the basic biology of aging side. And I think we should, because I think that's what we really have a chance to evaluate whether these interventions are working or not. The last thing I'll say on that is that, you know, I don't think that these functional measures are exclusively what we should be looking at. There's a lot of interest in looking at clocks, you know, biomarkers of aging. That absolutely is going to be important. The only point I would make is I don't think it's helpful if your intervention changes the biological clock and it doesn't improve functional measures of aging, right? Because that's really what we want to do. Those two things should go together. And if they don't, then I'd say your clock doesn't work very well.
I completely agree. I think that last point is so important because most people, I mean, care about functional measure and health span, whether they can still be healthy and functional as they get older. And right. Yeah, you're right. I mean, if my epigenetic biological clock is saying I'm whatever, like 20 years when I'm 50, but I still feel old and have right. these inflammatory conditions, I don't care about that number. So it doesn't matter really.
Yeah.
So actually one question on that, you mentioned there's so much heated debate around because we haven't decided what is a good definition of aging. Do you think it matters to actually define how the community, how people think of aging, or do you think it's not even necessary as long as, you know, we can work towards coming up with interventions or reversing or slowing aging?
Yeah, I guess my thoughts are that I don't think you're ever going to have one definition of aging, because again, it really depends on context, right? So, you know, sometimes we're talking about chronological age, you know, sometimes, you know, we might be talking about, you know, so this question of is aging a disease, right? I think it depends on the context. And I think it depends on, you know, what you're trying to communicate when you argue either side of that question, right? So I'm not so worried about trying to get, you know, absolute consensus on what aging is. What I think is more important is that, you know, we are clear in the definition that we're using in any given context or conversation, right? So I'm not so worried about trying to force everybody to fit one definition. And even this question of is aging a disease, I think it's a useful conversation to have, right? I don't really care, to be honest with you, you know, whether we call aging a disease or not. I think that, you know, it depends on who you're talking to and it depends on the point that you're trying to make. I honestly don't think it matters. I think you just have to be clear in what you mean when you're talking about aging in that conversation.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's like actually a great way to put it. A very unbiased way to put it, I'll say. Okay. So it'd be nice to move on to discussing some of the interventions that sure. people are working on right now. I think maybe starting with caloric restriction. Because that seems to be, I guess, the most popular one. Everyone talks about it. It seems to extend lifespan, maybe in mice. Not so sure in larger organisms, including monkeys and humans. And I believe there's also a genetic component to it. So what does the literature and data say on that, like the genetic component? And also, what does it say in humans?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is a really complicated and deep area of the literature. So it's hard to give a real simple answer to this question, right? So the observations, you know, this goes back to the 1930s, right? Originally, when people found that if you restricted food for rats, you could get significant increases in lifespan, 30, 40, 50% increases in lifespan. And then there was a whole set of studies done in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s in mice looking at caloric restriction in mice. So one thing that is clear is that you absolutely can get big lifespan extensions in mice from significant reductions in total caloric intake. In fact, you know, a lot of people in the field today aren't aware of this literature, but you know, the biggest effects from caloric restriction on lifespan in mice are up to about 65% increases in average lifespan at about a 60% restriction of food. So that's very extreme caloric restriction. Now, one of the reasons why that's important to appreciate is nobody in the field today is doing caloric restriction at that level. The studies you see today are typically 20, 30% restriction, right? So that's important because all of the studies that people are performing today are likely being done at a suboptimal level of restriction for lifespan, right? So any data you get from those kinds of studies, you just have to appreciate that's actually not the level of restriction that gives the biggest effects on lifespan. And so the way you interpret that data changes if you appreciate that point. The other thing to recognize is that the effects of caloric restriction in mice seem to be quite dependent on the genetic background. So I think it's fair to say, first of all, we don't really have a great understanding of the interaction of genotype with caloric restriction. But I think it's fair to say that there are some genetic backgrounds where caloric restriction has little to no effect. Again, with the caveat that those studies have been done only at one level of restriction, which is suboptimal, right? So it's a limited data set. Some genetic backgrounds, there's no effect. Some genetic backgrounds have their lifespan shortened, right? So this idea that caloric restriction is always beneficial is a myth. And that's clear from the data. What we don't know is if you were to take, you know, a large number of genetic backgrounds and test them at several levels of restriction, 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%, 50%, would you find a level of restriction where most or all genetic backgrounds do respond positively? We don't know that yet, okay? So there's an individual genetic component to the response to a given level of caloric restriction. And in some cases, it's harmful. What we don't know is, could you find a level of caloric restriction that's beneficial in any given genotype? Probably not, but probably most genetic backgrounds, you could find a level of restriction where you get some benefit. Okay, so that's, I think, a fair characterization of the data in mice. The other thing, though, to appreciate is that almost all of these studies, with the exception of one or two, have been done in inbred mouse strains that have been, you know, in the laboratory for many, many generations. So still a little bit of an open question. If you were to go out and get a bunch of different wild mice, you know, at least the genetic background of the wild mice, bring them in the laboratory and subject them to caloric restriction, what would that response profile look like? We really don't know the answer to that. One study, I think, has been done, and it was kind of mixed. It's unclear. So, and I think that, again, is an important, you know, when you think about translation to humans, it's important to appreciate the limitations of the studies that have been done in mice. But so given all of that, this is sort of my take. I think, you know, by and large, in most cases, caloric restriction, at least severe caloric restriction in mice, if done well, you will get a lifespan extension in most cases. And in most of those cases, it's not only lifespan that's extended, but health seems to be broadly improved. So those mice don't get cancer, and they seem to be functionally better at a later age than the mice that are fed ad libitum. So that's kind of my take on caloric restriction. Now, you know, related to that are questions of, you know, how much of that is due to fasting? How much of that is due to ketogenesis? What are the mechanisms at play? How much of that is due to time, you know, restricted feeding and circadian rhythms? That's stuff that people are still trying to figure out today, where we really don't have a great feeling for what the actual mechanisms are, other than, you know, we know that mTOR is inhibited and probably contributes to caloric restriction. We know that there are hormonal changes that are probably important, insulin, IGF-1, FGF-21, right? Those kinds of things probably play a role, but it's really still, you know, not well understood what the mechanisms are for how caloric restriction is having these effects.
And are these studies, when they show lifespan extension in mice, with caloric restriction, have they compared it to other, say, mice eating healthy diets, or is it mice just eating whatever they feel like and eating so-called junk food?
Yeah, I mean, there has been some work on this. So I'd say it's not consistent, right? So there is no, you know, generalization that I would say is fair in terms of the quality of the diet or the composition of the diet. So, and this is getting a little bit outside my area of expertise. So I'm perhaps not the most qualified person in the field to speak at length on this, but, you know, people have done comparisons to the macronutrient ratio in the diet. So, you know, protein, fat, carbohydrates, the sort of perception almost bordering on dogma in the field is that at least some of the effects of caloric restriction are due to protein restriction. You can find evidence in support of that. My personal view is it's not particularly great evidence, but you can certainly find evidence that supports that. But I would say there really isn't a consensus on, you know, diet, what diet quality is optimal in mice, right? So I don't think we can really answer that. The thing that does seem, I think, pretty compelling to me is the idea that at least part of the effects of caloric restriction require a prolonged fasting period. In fact, there's a really interesting paper from Dudley Lamming that just came out that supports this. But if you go back and look, there's a large body of evidence, and people have been saying this for a long time, right? That one of the likely important mechanisms for beneficial effects in the context of aging from caloric restriction is a prolonged period of fasting. And if you go back and look at, you know, the sort of classical literature from Rick Weindruck and Roy Walford and Ed Mazzaro, you know, in those studies, the mice were usually fed, or rats were usually fed, 3 times a week. So not only were they calorically restricted, but they had prolonged periods of fasting in between the feeding. And so I think that seems to be a pretty, to my view, there's a pretty compelling evidence that plays a significant role in the health benefits from caloric restriction in mice.
And when you say prolonged fasting here, you likely mean like 24 hours plus 48 hours, 72, no one really knows yet. But it's, I mean, would, because I know there's some people say that even intermittent fasting, like time restricted eating, fasting for like 16 hours mimics caloric restriction. I'm not sure whether that's true or not.
Right. So that's a different, I think what the way you framed it is right. I'm talking about, you know, something different than just one meal a day, right? Which I would call time restricted feeding. So I think there's a lot of confusion, especially, you know, when you look in the popular sort of the way this is portrayed to the general public, right? The terms time-restricted feeding and intermittent fasting get interchanged very much, right? So in mice, I think of time-restricted feeding as like, you know, a 8 hours in a day, they're getting their food, or, you know, one meal a day. Intermittent fasting would be something more than that, right? Where you really put them into a true fasting state, true ketogenesis, you know, that kind of a different metabolism. It's an open question, right? Whether, to what extent does, you know, shorter fasting periods have an effect on health and longevity? My personal view is that in mice, the data are extremely weak, that time-restricted feeding has significant effects on the aging process. It's still an area of you know, active study. So I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just not convinced by the data. There was one recent paper in fruit flies that I think, you know, suggested an interesting mechanism for time-restricted feeding, where if the time-restricted feeding matches up with the circadian rhythm, then you can get some benefits. If it doesn't match up with the circadian rhythm, then you probably don't get benefits. Again, it's a little bit weak, but that paper is kind of interesting. But the other thing I would say about that paper is the magnitude of effect there, the biggest effect that they got was 17% effect on lifespan, which compared to caloric restriction is tiny, right? So in some ways, I think the best you're ever going to do with time-restricted feeding is incremental. It's going to be nothing compared to the benefits that you're potentially going to get from something like true caloric restriction.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe prolonged fasting as well.
Yeah, maybe, right? But here's the thing, right? I'm not aware of any study of intermittent fasting or prolonged fasting that showed a real significant benefit in the context of aging, where they weren't also calorically restricted, right? So this is the thing that it's really hard. If you look at the literature, most of the studies where people have talked about every other day feeding or intermittent fasting, is also caloric restriction. So you really have to dig sometimes to find out, you know, were they isocaloric with the control group? And there's maybe like two papers where they're really isocaloric. And in those, the effects on lifespan were like 5%, 8%, tiny compared to caloric restriction.
Okay, great. So one last question on caloric restriction before we move on. What does it say, what does the study say in humans? Because I know with, at least with monkeys and humans, it seems like it's quite ambiguous whether it works or not, especially if you look at healthy humans. It seems like, I think there are some studies or maybe just experiments where it even has negative or like side effects in healthy humans.
Well, so I would first of all say caloric restriction always has side effects in everybody. Like I think this is a bit of a problem, I think, in the way people think about nutritional interventions, right? Is we tend to think of them as not having any side effects, which is ridiculous, right? You go try to eat 40% less for the next week and tell me you don't have any side effects. Come on. We need to be a little bit more realistic about what we mean, you know, when we're talking about benefits and side effects. I get hungry if I don't eat for, you know, 12 hours. You're going to be hungry if you restrict yourself by 40%. That's a side effect. It's not something you wanted to have happen, right? It's a side effect. So people practicing caloric restriction have lots of side effects. They're not terrible usually, but they're real. So poor thermoregulation is a well-documented side effect. People get cold when they're significantly calorically restricted, right? Lots and lots of reports of reproductive problems under severe caloric restriction in people, even when they're not malnourished, right? Increased risk of infection, I think, is a real concern, you know, when you're significantly calorically restricted. So lots of side effects. So I think that's important to appreciate. So what is the evidence for benefits from caloric restriction in people? So there have been a few controlled studies. The best is probably the calorie study, C-A-L-E-R-I-E. Actually, there's a whole bunch of papers that have been published from this. This was a series of clinical trials in people subjected to different levels of caloric restriction, sometimes combined with exercise, sometimes not. So again, this is a little bit outside my area of expertise. So there may be people who are better able to really comment on the details of these studies. My feeling from browsing that literature and reading some of it in depth is that there's pretty clear evidence of benefits, metabolic benefits in overweight people practicing caloric restriction. Not surprising, really, but I think those benefits are real and probably impact their health during aging. You know, is that really affecting the biology of aging? And, you know, where does, you know, metabolic disease and diabetes differ from regular aging? I don't know. But I think you can say there's probably pretty significant health benefits in overweight people from caloric restriction. Yeah, my feeling is there's not a ton of evidence for benefits in people who are at a healthy weight and also are moderately active, right? Exercise regularly. I can't say there aren't benefits. I'm just not convinced that there are a lot of benefits. And I think, again, you know, as I've already mentioned, there are side effects, right? So you have to sort of evaluate, you know, for yourself, if you're considering caloric restriction or fasting or time restricted feeding, you know, what's the risk reward ratio for you personally? That's the way I think about it. Hopefully that answers the question. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's super helpful. I love your point on side effects too, because I think in another podcast you mentioned, like, you know, even exercise, everyone knows it's great, but you still have side effects from that. Your muscles sore for a few days.
But that's right. And there are injuries. I think really thinking about what the definition of side effects is useful in, you know, considering the, like I said, the risk reward ratio, because that's really what it comes down to, right? For all of these interventions, where we think there's the potential that it could improve your health as you get older, it's all about a risk reward. And you know, for a lot of these, we can't know what the actual risk reward ratio is, right? Yeah. But I think, you know, if you're educated about the literature, you can come to your own decisions, you know, about what your tolerance for risk is and what you think the potential beneficial effects might be.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so sirtuins, I believe you're the one who actually discovered it. What does it say? And I know there was like a lot of hype on it regarding sirtuins and longevity for humans.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what it says in yeast, worms, and also human studies?
Sure. So this is, again, it's kind of like caloric restriction. There's a lot to unpack when it comes to sirtuins, but I'll try to do the like 2 minute version here. So you're right. So it was my graduate work along with Mitch McVeigh, who was a grad student in the Grantee lab at the same time, that first showed in yeast that if you overexpressed this gene called SIR2, that we could extend lifespan. And we had, you know, we had a reason to go looking at SIR2 at the time, and that I won't get into, but that was before anybody was studying sirtuins, or before the word sirtuins actually, you know, existed. So the word sirtuin comes from SIR2. So SIR2N is a family of enzymes that are all related to the yeast SIR2 gene that we overexpressed and extended lifespan. And they are sort of unique in the sense that they have a specific enzymatic activity. They're what are called NAD-dependent deacetylases. And so what that means is they use NAD, which is a cofactor, a metabolic cofactor, to deacetylate proteins. And in yeast, they deacetylate histones, which ties into epigenetics, right? So they're an epigenetic regulator. And that's their mechanism of extending lifespan in yeast. So, you know, when we published this, not too many people paid a lot of attention to it because it was in yeast. I think when people really started to get interested was when Heidi Tissenbaum, who was a postdoc in the Grantee lab at the time, showed that if you overexpressed the worm version of SIR2, which is called SIR2.1, you could extend lifespan in worms. And I think that caught people's attention because then all of a sudden it wasn't a yeast specific thing, it was more general. And then Steve Helfand's lab published that if you did that in flies, you could extend lifespan in flies. And then for many, many years, I mean, this was back, you know, the early 2000s when the worm and the fly work were done, you know, for many, many years, people tried to show that you could do the same thing in mice, and it just didn't work, or it worked, you know, barely. There's one paper now showing that if you overexpress the mouse version of SIR2, which is called SIRT1, in brain, in a very specific region of brain, you can get a small effect on lifespan. So I don't really know how to interpret that because, you know, if you try to do the same experiment enough times, eventually you might get a small effect. Is it real? Is it important? I don't know. So my view on SIRT1 is it does a lot. So the biology is important. How effective it is as an aging target, a little bit unclear. The thing about sirtuins is, at least in mammals, there are 7 of them. So there's SIRT1 through SIRT7 in mice and people. So that gives you a lot more shots on goal to go out there and try to find something, you know, important for aging. And the one that looks like the best case can be made right now is a sirtuin called SIRT6, where if you overexpress that in mice, you can get lifespan extension that looks pretty real. I don't remember the percent effect, but I think it's around 20%. So it's not tiny by mouse lifespan experiments. The interesting thing about SIRT6 is of all the sirtuins, it's the one that's probably got the function closest to yeast SIR2 in the sense that it's a histone deacetylase. So, you know, maybe there's something really useful there. My sort of view on sirtuins is, if you just look at the literature as a whole, they're in the same network that affects aging as mTOR and insulin signaling and AMP kinase. So these things are all interacting. I'm still not completely convinced that sirtuins are going to be a particularly useful target from an interventional perspective. A lot of other people think they are, and a lot of other people are studying this. So I'm not saying they're not going to be, but I haven't really seen anything that makes me think that they're particularly important or particularly good targets from a therapeutic perspective for affecting the biology of aging. But they're, you know, they're in the neighborhood. They're in there with the rest of the network.
I see. And one thing you mentioned was that sirtuins are NAD dependent. Is there any data showing that if you boost levels of NAD through precursors, it boosts either independently affects longevity, or by boosting the activity of sirtuins has any effect whatsoever?
Yeah, there's absolutely data out there, and you'll find, you know, many people, I don't know about many, there are people in the field who will argue that's exactly what NAD precursors are doing, is activating sirtuins and increasing lifespan. You'll find other people who will say that that's nonsense, right? So I guess what I would say is there's no data that has been reproducible and convinces me that NAD precursors are slowing aging by activating sirtuins in a mammal. Right. So the one study in mice that showed a significant lifespan extension from nicotinamide riboside, which is one of the NAD precursors, that was a study where older mice were treated with nicotinamide riboside, I think from 18 or 20 months of age. And there was a lifespan extension. I don't remember the exact percent, but it was in the 15 to 20% range, I think. So that was a really nice study in some ways, because they showed not only lifespan extension, but other metabolic effects consistent with effects on aging. But if you actually look at the data for the lifespan experiment, their control strain was really, really short-lived. And the nicotinamide riboside treated strain was not really much longer than where the control strain should have been in a study where you had a normal lived control strain. So it's not a super compelling piece of data from that experiment that the treatment actually had a big effect on lifespan. And then when you combine that with the fact that the interventions testing program tried to test nicotinamide riboside for lifespan extension in a different strain background, they saw no effect. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my feeling is that there's not really much reason to believe that nicotinamide riboside has big effects on aging in mice. And, you know, the whole rationale for people taking these NAD precursors is based on the mouse data, right? So not a lot of rationale in my view yet that these things can boost health and longevity in people. But, you know, as I said, there are other people in the field who are very smart scientists who, you know, really think that there's a lot of good reason to believe that these NAD precursors can have effects on health and longevity. And so, you know, that's my opinion. I'm sometimes it takes a bit more to convince me than it takes to convince other people.
Fair. Yeah. No, I'm curious for the data to come out and the actual studies done. So you mentioned mTOR a couple of times. Can you explain what mTOR is? And I think also maybe the distinction between mTOR1 and mTOR2, and then we can move on to how rapamycin interacts with mTOR and what gets you so excited about rapamycin.
Sure. So I'll start from kind of a conceptual perspective, because I think in order to understand, you know, what mTOR is and what it does, it's useful to start from that sort of a perspective. So, you know, the way I think about it is, if you think back through evolutionary sort of timescales, there are a few fundamental decisions that every organism has to make that, you know, are really important for the evolutionary success of that organism, right? So I'm thinking about this from, you know, the perspective of natural selection and evolution, right? So let's just say you're a single-celled organism. You know, you need to query the environment and make a decision based on the environment. Is it a good time to reproduce or not, right? Because if you reproduce at the wrong time and it's a bad environment, your progeny are going to die and you're not going to be evolutionarily successful. So one way to think about mTOR is it is one of the major factors in the cell that helps cells make that decision, sense the environment, and based on the environment, decide whether to reproduce or not. And so if you think about the things in the environment that are really the key determinants of that decision, there's not very many, right? There's food, which is probably the most important. There's no food around, don't have babies. That's a good evolutionary strategy. Temperature, the temperature's wrong. You probably don't want to reproduce. You want to become stress resistant. And maybe oxygen, depending on, you know, what sort of organism you are. So, and mTOR responds to all of those, right? So basically nutrient levels is probably the most important factor that regulates mTOR, but mTOR also responds to oxygen and also responds to temperature. So mTOR is sort of the gatekeeper of reproduction is the way I think about it. Since the environment signals through, you know, still being worked out pathways to increase or decrease mTOR activity based on the environment. High mTOR activity is associated with growth and reproduction. So lots of food, high mTOR. Low mTOR activity is associated with shutting down reproduction and becoming stress resistant. Not very much food, low mTOR. Okay. So what rapamycin does is it inhibits mTOR. So it kind of tricks the cell into thinking that it's a low food environment, shuts down growth and reproduction or turns it down, and enhances stress resistance. So that's a very sort of simplistic viewpoint of mTOR, but I think that captures, you know, conceptually at least what mTOR does. Now, from a biochemical perspective, mTOR is what's called a kinase, which means it phosphorylates other proteins. Kinases are sort of classical signaling molecules. So that fits with this idea that, you know, mTOR is really the node that helps signal from the environment to all the downstream processes that cells need to grow and reproduce. So So TOR is the protein. Don't get confused. You'll often see it referred to as mTOR. The M, this is sort of a weird historical artifact. So the M used to stand for mammalian target of rapamycin to differentiate it from the non-mammalian target of rapamycin. But now we know they do essentially exactly the same thing. So the M now stands for mechanistic target of rapamycin because it's not mammalian specific anymore. Doesn't matter. mTOR is the same as TOR. TOR stands for target of rapamycin because rapamycin is an inhibitor of TOR. Okay, so TOR is the protein. It's a kinase, and it acts in two different complexes. So this is what you were referring to as mTOR complex 1 and mTOR complex 2. So if you hear mTORC 1, mTOR complex 1, mTORC 2, mTOR complex 2. Okay, so these different complexes have other proteins that interact with TOR, and they're different in the two complexes. And the two complexes seem to regulate different downstream processes. And so from the context of aging, most of the data support the idea that it's inhibition of mTOR complex 1 that leads to increased lifespan and increased health span. And rapamycin is biochemically a specific inhibitor of mTOR complex 1. The mechanism of that doesn't really matter, but it's what's called an allosteric inhibitor, meaning that rapamycin binds to another protein called FKBP12. And it's that complex of rapamycin with FKBP12 that inhibits mTOR complex 1. So the sort of complicated twist on this is that if you treat with enough rapamycin for long enough, you can get secondary effects on mTOR complex 2. And so, you know, there's a model that's almost achieved the level of dogma in the field that the beneficial effects of rapamycin in mice are due to inhibition of mTOR complex 1, and the detrimental effects, the side effects of rapamycin in both mice and people, are due to off-target effects on mTOR complex 2. I think there's data to support that, but I think that it's a bit of an oversimplistic idea that mTOR complex 1 good, mTOR complex 2 bad, right? I think it's more complicated than that. But that's at least, you know, what people are thinking is that if you could find versions of rapamycin that are more specific for mTOR complex 1, you might be able to still get all the benefits without the side effects. That hasn't happened yet. Nobody's showing that's true yet, but there's a lot of buzz around that idea, and people are trying to find these molecules. So then, you know, for rapamycin, I think one of the reasons why I still view rapamycin as you know, the gold standard of longevity interventions, at least pharmacological longevity interventions, is that we know that rapamycin itself can increase lifespan in every animal model or cellular model where it's been tested, yeast, worms, flies, mice. Rapamycin increases lifespan. We know that the genetic correlate of that, so genetically turning down mTOR complex 1, also increases lifespan in all of those model systems. So you've got the drug, you've got the genetics lining up. And it's by far the most robust and reproducible pharmacological intervention for increasing lifespan in mice. So unlike things like nicotinamide riboside, where, you know, one person reports it extends lifespan, another group can't reproduce it. Same thing with sirtuin activators. Everybody gets rapamycin to extend lifespan, and it's usually not small effects. So, you know, I think the lowest effect is 9% that's been reported, and the highest is around 30%. And it, you know, usually in that 20% range, which is kind of my cutoff for something I really feel comfortable about when somebody publishes a paper in mice. If it's less than 20%, I'm sort of like, I don't know, let's wait and see if somebody else can reproduce it first. But rapamycin has been reproduced many different labs, multiple strain backgrounds. So it really seems robust. Now, you know, we talked earlier about the genetic variation in the response to caloric restriction. I do think, you know, we have to be honest, rapamycin hasn't been tested in nearly as many genetic backgrounds as caloric restriction. So it's been shown to extend lifespan in, you know, I think 4 different genetic backgrounds now, but well, we don't know whether it's going to work the same way across. If we were to look at 20 different genetic backgrounds, would it work in all of them, in some of them? We don't know the answer to that yet. So that's an important outstanding question. But I would say it is definitely the most robust and reproducible pharmacological method for extending lifespan in mice. And it's not only lifespan, but in pretty much every organ or tissue where you look, you can find evidence that rapamycin is either delaying the declines in function, or I think what's most exciting, actually reversing functional declines associated with aging. And we talked about functional measures of aging. And I think if you can reverse, if you can take an old mouse where function is not very good, treat it for eight weeks with a drug and make function better, that's exactly what we want, right? And we know that's true for rapamycin, at least in immune, brain, heart, and oral cavity. You see reversal of aging functional declines in about 6 to 8 weeks of treatment. So it's pretty exciting.
That is really exciting. I have to say, as I was doing research for this and looking up your work in rapamycin, it got me extremely excited about it. I was telling my friends, I'm like, oh, this is the other thing I want to be studying more of. So when it comes to health span benefits, you mentioned it reverses the functional decline as well. Is that something, as in like you've seen it for older mice, does it work in younger mice too? Is there sort of like an age? Because I guess you probably don't want to inhibit mTOR when you're younger, right?
So I think we don't really know. I mean, I think definitely when you're talking about development, right, you probably don't want to significantly inhibit mTOR. The expectation would be if you did, you would get slower development and probably smaller adult body size. Now, you know, that actually smaller adult body size in and of itself in the long run may have beneficial effects for health and longevity. But I certainly would not suggest that, you know, that we should be thinking about treating teenagers or kids with rapamycin, right? I mean, I think that's off the table, at least for aging. There are certain diseases where it might make sense, but not for aging. But I will say there are a couple of interesting studies that have suggested that even in young mice, for some of the parameters where rapamycin seems to benefit old mice, you see the same sort of trends in young mice. So, you know, improvements or changes in function going in the same direction, even in young mice. It's interesting because, you know, there's at least one paper that has argued that suggests that rapamycin may not be affecting aging, right? If you're seeing the same effects in young mice as in old mice, you know, maybe it's not really affecting aging. And I understand the logic of that argument. I think what that argument misses is that rapamycin isn't only affecting one thing, right? It's affecting, broadly speaking, every aspect of aging that we can measure. So while it might be the case that there are changes, or I hesitate to say improvements because you're talking about a young animal that's already functioning pretty well, changes in function in young animals that are in the same direction as the changes in function in old animals, at least maybe in heart, for example. I don't think that's an argument that rapamycin isn't affecting aging. It just means that rapamycin has effects in young animals as well. But to get back to your earlier point, I think one of the really exciting things about rapamycin from a translational perspective is that you don't have to start in young age, right? So, you know, the first study to show that, I think, was the 2009 study from the intervention testing program, where they started treating mice at 20 months of age with rapamycin, and they saw they could get a significant lifespan benefit. That was really the first convincing study that you could treat with a drug in middle age and get significant effects on lifespan. I think before that time, myself included, almost everybody in the field would have said, you know, you probably have to start when you're young because what these things are doing are just slowing the decline, right? I think what that study did is it really changed the way we think about intervention in aging. And now we have, you know, many, many more studies since then that have shown that, yeah, in fact, you can take an old mouse and actually make things better, right? And that's a real conceptual shift, I think, in the way the field is approaching aging. And from a translational perspective, it's really important, right? Because it's much easier to envision an intervention that you can start treating people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s and get a benefit than something you would have to start treating people when they're 18, right? That's not realistic at this point. So I think that's been a really important change in the way that we think about the biology of aging. And largely that can be traced back to that study with rapamycin in 2009.
That's a great point and very exciting. Now, is it true that low protein diets are having the same effect in inhibiting mTOR as rapamycin, and how does it compare with rapamycin?
Right. So I think the answer is yes, that a low protein diet is predicted to inhibit mTOR. It's a little bit unclear whether it's not going to be the same as rapamycin. I think that's one thing that's useful to appreciate. First and foremost. So, you know, I think it's easier to think about with caloric restriction. So if you think about caloric restriction, I told you earlier, you know, one of the main things mTOR does is it senses nutrients in the environment, right? And when nutrients are low, mTOR gets turned down. So caloric restriction will absolutely inhibit mTOR. Rapamycin will inhibit mTOR. But the downstream biological effects are going to be different between those two treatments, right? So first of all, caloric restriction does a bunch of other stuff in addition to inhibiting mTOR. Rapamycin is a very specific inhibitor of mTOR, right? So by that extent, caloric restriction is a massively dirty drug and rapamycin is a really, really clean drug. So you'll see people publish papers where they say, oh, we did gene expression studies of caloric restriction and gene expression studies of rapamycin and they look different. Therefore, these things are completely different mechanisms. That's just silly. Of course, they're different. They're different interventions, right? But they have an overlap. And the overlap is you're inhibiting mTOR in both situations. But the point I'm trying to make is that the effects of inhibiting mTOR in the context of caloric restriction might be somewhat subtly or not subtly different than the effects of inhibiting mTOR in a nutrient replete condition, when you know the metabolic state is different when you're starving or fasting than it is when you're fully fed. And the effects of inhibiting mTOR in those two contexts might be different. In fact, they will be different. We just don't know how different they are. So, you know, this question of protein restriction, is it a mimic of caloric of rapamycin? To some extent it is, but it's also different. And it's not really clear, first of all, that protein restriction itself inhibits mTOR as effectively as rapamycin does. Because again, remember, rapamycin is a very potent and specific inhibitor of mTOR. So both of them will inhibit mTOR. My guess is rapamycin will be more potent. And also the kinetics of mTOR inhibition are going to be different, right? So for example, if you take rapamycin once a week, you'll have strong mTOR inhibition, say on Sunday, and then rapamycin will get cleared over the next couple of days. And then you'll have full mTOR activation, you know, maybe Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, right? Mm-hmm. If you're on a consistently protein-restricted diet, what you might have is lower mTOR, maybe not as severely inhibited as the day after you take rapamycin, but it's going to stay low all week long, right? Mm-hmm. So the effects of the two interventions are potentially going to be quite different. And I think in terms of which is more beneficial, we really don't know. At this point, all I would say is if you look in the mouse literature, again, much like intermittent fasting and time-restricted feeding, it's really not clear that protein restriction per se gives big effects on lifespan in the absence of caloric restriction. Most of the protein restriction studies that have been done are also caloric restriction studies. The one example where I think you can make a case for something like protein restriction having, you know, at least moderate effects on lifespan independent of caloric intake are specific amino acid restrictions. So methionine restriction or branch chain amino acid restriction, there's pretty good data for both of those that you can get significant effects on lifespan in situations where the mice are actually eating more. So one of the responses to branch chain amino acid or methionine restriction is actually an increase in appetite. So that doesn't seem to be due to caloric restriction. It seems to be something about the specific restriction of those amino acids. Again, those regimens will inhibit mTOR. So I think inhibition of mTOR is probably part of the effect that they're having, but they also do other things. And so it still remains to be worked out, you know, how much of the benefits that you see in those studies are due to mTOR inhibition versus other effects that they have.
That's a really useful explanation, because I think a lot of times when people say this mimics this, you don't realize that, yes, there are certain overlaps, but as you said, underneath mechanistically, there are also lots of different things that are happening and ends up having different consequences and outcomes as a result.
That's right.
Yeah. One thing I want to go back to was mTOR2, complex 2. Do we know much about it? And is there anything being done to figure that out?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, certainly we know a growing amount about mTOR complex 2. I would say, you know, 10 years ago, almost all of the studies were on mTOR complex 1 and there wasn't a lot known about mTOR complex 2. That is changing and there are ongoing studies, you know, further establishing the different downstream effects of mTOR complex 2, as well as its upstream regulation. One thing I'll say that, you know, I think has emerged is that that mTOR complex, not surprisingly, I guess, if you really think about it, but mTOR complex 1 and mTOR complex 2 are tightly interconnected. So there are many, if you look at the network diagram, right, there are many ways that these two complexes talk to each other. And they're both interacting with insulin signaling, IGF-1 signaling, metabolism. So I think, you know, while we really like to try to draw linear diagrams, we really have to think about the mTOR network as a network. And it's really hard to predict, you know, right now, how perturbing the network in one place might have effects beyond just mTOR complex 1 and mTOR complex 2. You know, as an example, we published a paper in a mouse model of mitochondrial disease that we study. It's a mouse that's deficient for complex 1 of the electron transport chain. It's a model of a childhood disease called Leigh syndrome. So these mice are very sick. They have severe mitochondrial dysfunction, and they develop neurodegeneration about 35 to 40 days of age. And then they usually die by about 55 to 60 days of age. So it's very much an early onset disease, like is seen in people with Leigh syndrome. And we found several years ago that rapamycin could double or triple the survival of these mice and basically prevent the neurodegenerative component of the disease. And, you know, my assumption all along was that this was due to mTOR complex 1 inhibition, right? Mm-hmm. And so we did a phosphoproteomic study and proteomic study with Judith Villain, who's at the University of Washington. And what we found from that study, there's a lot of interesting changes happening, but one of the things we found from that study is that, maybe not surprisingly, given the other literature out there, but we weren't really expecting it. We saw dramatic downregulation at both the phosphoproteomic as well as the proteomic level of mTOR complex 2 components. So in these mice treated with rapamycin in the brain, we got inhibition of mTOR complex 1 as we expected, but we also got massive downregulation of mTOR complex 2. And we were actually able to map that to regulation of mTOR complex 2 on protein kinase C as partly being important for the disease suppression, not the whole story, but part of the story. So, you know, it made me really rethink this idea that inhibition of mTOR complex 1 is good and inhibition of mTOR complex 2 is bad. At least in this context, severe mitochondrial dysfunction, it seems to be the case that inhibition of mTOR complex 2 from chronic rapamycin treatment was part of the rescue of the disease. And nobody yet has gone back and really tried to tease this out in the context of normal aging. But it's not going to shock me if that ends up being the case, that it's actually interaction with both complexes that's contributing to the beneficial effects that we see. And maybe the side effects as well, right? Again, I this remains to be worked out. One of the really missing pieces of data in the literature is there are drugs that hit both complexes roughly equally. So rapamycin, I mentioned, is an allosteric inhibitor that binds to mTOR complex 1. There are other types of drugs that are called catalytic inhibitors or ATP competitive inhibitors that hit the active site of both of mTOR in both complexes. So you can inhibit both complexes at the same time. Nobody's done an aging study with those drugs. I'm not sure why, but it's really a big missing gap in the literature. And I think would tell us something. You know, if you saw similar benefits as with rapamycin with those drugs, that would probably suggest that we should reevaluate sort of the current thinking about mTOR complex 1 and mTOR complex 2.
Have there been any studies done with the catalytic inhibitor?
Not in the context of aging that I'm aware of. So it's possible there's unpublished data out there, but I haven't seen anything published.
I see. Okay. Out of curiosity, where did this dogma come from then that mTOR 2 is always bad?
So it really comes from largely genetic studies that Dudley Lamming did when he was in David Sabatini's lab, where they made a series of mice that were deficient for mTOR complex 1 or mTOR complex 2. And what they saw in those studies is that if you knocked down mTOR complex 2 enough, you could shorten lifespan, and you saw metabolic dysregulation that is consistent with some of the side effects people think about with rapamycin. So that's really, to my knowledge, the only real evidence for this idea that inhibition of mTOR complex 2 is bad and inhibition of mTOR complex 1 is good in the context of aging, right? Other than the fact that rapamycin is certainly a specific inhibitor of mTOR complex 1, at least biochemically. We already talked about the fact that long-term treatment, you get you get other effects on mTOR complex too. So, you know, that's really where this model came from, and it has just sort of been propagated without really being tested in any real detail, I would say. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying that it's not, the data in support of it aren't as strong as it gets presented sometimes.
I see. Yeah. So you've been testing rapamycin in dogs. Can you tell us a bit about the dog aging project?
Sure. So there's really two parts to the dog aging project. The biggest component is not the rapamycin trial. It's what we call the longitudinal study of aging. About 33,000 dogs in that study now. And the goal of that study is completely non-interventional. It's just to follow dogs over time, try to understand the most important genetic and environmental determinants of health outcomes during aging. So all of the owners in the longitudinal study complete an extensive health and life experiences survey where we collect environmental information, health history, all sorts of information about that the dog's home life. And we ask the owners to also provide electronic veterinary medical records. And then all of the dogs in the longitudinal study, also their owners complete a cognitive assessment. So we get health, environment, cognitive function, and health records. Dogs whose owners do that are eligible for the sampled cohorts, one of which is in fact the clinical trial. There are two other sampled cohorts, the foundation cohort, which is 10,000 dogs that have their genome sequenced, and then the precision cohort, which is 1,000 dogs that it's sort of like our systems biology cohort. Every year, the dogs go into their private veterinarian. We get, you know, the results of that veterinary exam, blood chemistry, but then we also get serum metabolome, blood epigenome, and fecal microbiome on those dogs every year. So again, that's non-interventional. We're following those dogs over hopefully their entire lives and trying to understand, you know, what correlates with health outcomes during aging.
So sorry to intervene, but that's more seeing lifestyle circumstances, how
and genetics.
Eating or what their and genetics. Okay. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Trying to capture as much of that as we can and understand what correlates with health outcomes. And you'll notice I keep saying correlate, right? I think it's important to appreciate, you know, these longitudinal studies are they're hypothesis generating, but you can't infer causality from the correlation. So we have to, mm-hmm. you know, later on, somebody will go back and test the hypotheses. And, you know, there are similar longitudinal studies in people. The Baltimore longitudinal study of aging is a good example. Where, you know, people are being followed over many, many years, sometimes decades, to try to do those same sorts of correlative analyses. So the clinical trial is different, right? That's TRIAD, which stands for Test of Rapamycin in Aging Dogs. The goal of that clinical trial is really to test, does rapamycin slow aging in dogs? It's a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled clinical trial. It'd be about 500 dogs, half placebo, half rapamycin treated. The treatment period is for 1 year, and then there's 2 years of follow-up. And the dogs have to be at least 7 years old when they come into the study. So with that demographic group, and they're bigger dogs, they have to be between 40 and I think 110 pounds. So with that age and size cohort, that time length, 3 years, and that number of dogs, about 500, gives us statistical power to detect a 9% change in lifespan. So lifespan is the primary endpoint of that study. Which makes it sort of unique in the aging field for clinical study. And then secondary endpoints are a variety of health span measures, both functional measures, like all of the dogs will get echocardiograms every 6 months, we'll get cognitive assessments every 6 months, we'll get activity assessments, as well as disease incidence. So, you know, how frequently do the dogs get cancer, kidney disease, liver disease, infections, things like that. So we're really trying to look as broadly as we can at health span using a variety of different secondary endpoints.
And is there a reason why there's a size restriction and why it's bigger dogs?
Yeah, bigger dogs age faster than smaller dogs. At least that's generally speaking, that's true. So certainly big dogs live shorter than smaller dogs. So size is the strongest predictor of lifespan in dogs. And when you look across, when you look at most age-related diseases, it seems as though big dogs get them at earlier ages, right? So as if they are actually aging in an accelerated way. The one interesting difference might be cognitive function. So you know, there's some evidence in the literature, and I think our early returns from the longitudinal study are pretty clear that when it comes to cognitive decline, big dogs are not at a higher risk or and don't show cognitive decline in an accelerated way. So that's kind of interesting, and it might suggest something different about cognitive aging versus aging in the rest of the body.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And how did you come up with the 1 year timeline of treating them 1 year? Is this also every day treating them with rapamycin? Is it
weekly? Yeah, good question. So so the 1 year timeline, so first thing to appreciate with any clinical trial is you have to take an educated guess, right? There are so many things you have to decide on: dose, duration, frequency, you know, demographics of the study population, right? So all of this is an educated guess. And I think we have to be honest about that. You kind of, you know, look at all of the information you have at hand, consider the risk and the reward, and try to come up with the design that gives you the best opportunity to be successful while minimizing the risk to the participants, right? So all of that weighed into our study design. And there were lots and lots of things that we considered. But specifically for the 1 year timeline and the dose that we're testing and the frequency, it was informed by a few different things. So the 1 year timeline was a balance between the literature, where a study from my lab that we published, I think in 2016, we showed that if you take 20 month old mice and you treat them for 3 months and then stop the treatment, you get significant increases in lifespan and at least some measures of health span just from that 3 month treatment period. So we kind of tried to extrapolate from that to what we thought sort of the equivalent biological period would be in a dog. And that's how we came up with it, the 1 year treatment. The reason for not doing a 3 year treatment was, you know, in part to minimize the risk, right? Again, because these are not that we think there are really any significant risks of side effects based on our own pilot clinical trials and data that's out there, you know, because these are healthy dogs and they're people's pets, you really want to be sure that you're minimizing the risk as much as possible. And so we felt that 1 year treatment period, you know, there was enough reason to think that it would provide benefits. And obviously the shorter the treatment, the lower the potential risk of side effects, right? That's actually one nice thing about rapamycin and other mTOR inhibitors is very clearly from the human clinical literature, the side effects all go away when people stop taking the drug, right? So, and that's higher doses of the drug in sick people. But even there, where there are some real side effects, they're all transient when they stop taking the drug. So we just kind of thought that was about the right place to land in terms of risk reward. The 2 year follow-up to give us a 3 year observational period, that's what gives us the statistical power to detect an effect on lifespan, right? We need that longer observational period to be able to detect if rapamycin is having any effect on lifespan.
Yep. Will you also be able to test whether this works in different genetic types? Because I think one thing you mentioned was that we don't know that about rapamycin yet. Yep.
In a sense, so we're not powered. We don't have enough dogs to be able to identify specific genotypes, if there are specific genotypes where rapamycin works better or worse. Mm-hmm. What we did do was, and this again was one of the decisions we needed to make when we were designing the trial, we made the decision that we were going to work in a genetically heterogeneous population. So we are not restricting entry into the study based on genotype. And we have roughly equal numbers of purebred and mixed breed dogs. But among purebred dogs, we're sampling a variety of different breeds. And the only thing we are doing is making sure we're not overrepresented for the really, really popular breeds like golden retrievers, right? But the study was designed intentionally to have a diverse genetic pool. That absolutely has the potential to increase the noise. But, you know, one of the reasons for doing this is to understand, does rapamycin really affect aging in the real world, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, one goal is to someday know whether rapamycin affects aging in people, right? So we felt that, you know, since that's an important goal, it only made sense really to do the study in the real world, and the real world is genetically diverse. So that was sort of my rationale for why I really pushed for not restricting based on genotype.
Amazing. I believe one thing you mentioned was that you saw an interesting pattern with feeding frequency of dogs and I think just health, healthy status of dogs. I think you were going to publish some data on that. I'm not sure if it's out yet. If you can.
No, it's not. Something. So the paper, okay. The paper, I think will be submitted next week. We got a positive pre-submission inquiry response, and so hopefully the paper will be submitted next week, and hopefully it'll be out soon. I think we'll probably put it on BioArchive about the time we submitted, so it should be at least available for people to see the preprint. So I'll tell you the rationale and the design for that study, but I'm not going to tell you the result because it's not. I'd be happy to tell you. The only reason I'm not telling you is to be respectful of my co-authors. So anyways, the idea here was pretty straightforward, right? We talked about, you know, the questions around time-restricted feeding and intermittent fasting, and I was in the process of writing a review, which actually I think will be coming out in the next week or so as well, on, you know, so-called anti-aging diets, right? So caloric mm-hmm. restriction, time-restricted feeding, protein restriction, all of those things. And so I was kind of in the middle of writing that review. And it occurred to me that pet dogs are this really interesting model for, you know, different feeding frequencies. Some people feed their dog all the time. Some people two times a day, some people once a day. And that we have this, you know, set of about 30,000 dogs that, you know, were that distribution. And so we looked at the data and it turns out that maybe not surprisingly, most of the owners in our cohort feed their dogs twice a day. I think it's something like 70%. Some 10% or so feed their dogs more often than that. And about 10% feed their dogs once a day. And I thought that once a day group is a really interesting, maybe, model for time-restricted feeding. Mm-hmm. So the question here is pretty simple, right? We've got a bunch of dogs fed a different number of times a day, independent of what the diet actually is. Is there any correlation between feeding frequency and different health outcomes? We don't have lifespan yet because this is part of the longitudinal study, but we have information on a whole bunch of different disease diagnoses for these dogs. So we can look at different disease categories and say, is there any correlation between feeding frequency and risk of different diseases? And so I think we ended up settling on, I think, 9 different disease categories. And, you know, they included cognitive function and kidney disease and liver disease and gastrointestinal. There were 3 or 4 others. So different disease categories that are all age related. And we did the analysis, did a couple of different types of analysis. The simplest one was just take all the dogs that are fed once a day and compare them to the dogs that are fed more than once a day. Again, not worrying about what they're actually fed, just how often are they fed. And the results are interesting. And I'll leave it there. They're really, really interesting. And I think, to my view, pretty compelling. So, you know, you'll have to stay tuned. But I was pleasantly surprised that it gave such a, you know, strong observational result, right? Again, you know, you have to be careful about causality, right? So there could be other things that are associated with how frequently a dog is fed. In fact, there almost certainly are. Right. But I think it's certainly from a hypothesis generating perspective, you know, quite interesting. And you know, down the road might actually guide recommendations to owners on you know, how often they feed their dogs. One of the things that hopefully we'll be able to do in the future is actually follow up and see not only, you know, how often are the dogs being fed, but what are they actually being fed? And is that at all correlated with the health outcomes?
That was going to be my next question, whether if you went back and checked whether, I mean, some of the correlation was also based on what they were eating versus just feeding frequency.
Yeah, we don't know at this point. So we don't have great data on dietary composition. That's one of the things we want to build into the future surveys that we send out, is, you know, to get more information, not only about how often are they fed, but what are they fed. You might also imagine that feeding frequency would be correlated with risk of obesity, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So there are lots of things that tie into it that we can't really resolve at this point with the current data set.
Right. I'll watch out for that though. Very curious. Okay, so just closing the chapter on rapamycin and mTOR, are there any, what sort of studies would you like to see being done? I know we discussed figuring out more on mTOR2 and catalytic inhibitors. What else do you think you'd like to see being done?
Well, I mean, I think if I had my wish, what I would really like to see being done are, I mean, I think obviously there's lots to be done on the basic science side to figure out the downstream mechanisms. And, you know, we're doing some of that in my lab. Lots of people are working on that. What I'd really like to see are a series of smart clinical trials with rapamycin or rapamycin derivatives in people to see whether or not we can have an impact on multiple different types of age-related indications. And, you know, that's been one of the most disappointing things is, given that I don't think anybody would argue, at least nobody who's serious would argue that, that rapamycin isn't the most effective drug for targeting aging in mice, right? The data are so rock solid and crystal clear, there just can't be any real debate among legitimate people. Given that, it's been really disappointing how few clinical trials have been carried out in this area. In part, that's because rapamycin has a bad reputation, because it's been used mostly in organ transplant patients at high doses. So there are concerns about the side effects. Those concerns are overblown, but they are a hindrance to clinical trials. The other thing is rapamycin's off patent, so nobody's going to make money off of it, right? And so I think those two things together have really hindered the testing of rapamycin in clinical trials compared to some of the things that don't work nearly as well, in at least in mice, right? Senolytics, NAD precursors, all these supplements, right? They don't work very well. Rapamycin works really well, and yet you've got clinical trials going for all these other things. So that's what I would like to see. I would like to see multiple clinical trials of rapamycin for different endpoints in people. So hopefully that'll happen. I mean, I think there are a few things that different people are working on. We're still trying to get a clinical trial going for periodontal disease. I think that periodontal disease is a really nice endpoint. It's non-invasive, typical dental exam, right? So you don't have to burden the patients, right? And it's pretty clear in mice that we can reverse clinically defining features of periodontal disease that can be measured in a dental exam. So I think that's a real obvious place where a clinical trial can and should be done. And there are others. And so that's what I would really like to see. If I had a couple hundred million dollars, that's where I'd put it.
That's very insightful. I mean, as you mentioned that, you know, science also is not immune to other factors that come in terms of rapamycin being off patent and also just the bad rep that it gets. I wish it was, but it's important to take all these things in perspective.
That's right. Yeah, and it all plays into it. And there are all sorts of factors that influence on the funding side, what kinds of grants get funded, and then what gets, you know, moved into the clinical realm and how long it takes. And, you really see this in every field. Alzheimer's field is, you know, probably even worse than the aging field, right? Look at how long the field has been focused on the A-beta hypothesis, right? People are finally now starting to push back against that. But that's just the culture of research and clinical medicine and biotechnology.
Yeah. One last thing I wanted to discuss with you was inflammaging. I know you mentioned how you've recently become very bullish on it. Can you just briefly explain what it is, why I guess you got more bullish on it, and any sort of therapies that are being developed or tested to target this inflammation process?
Sure. So I'm not an immunologist. I'll start with that disclaimer. So I'm gonna talk about inflammaging from a very sort of high level, conceptual, simplistic perspective. So first thing I think it's important to appreciate is, and I'm guilty of this sometimes too, you know, we often talk about immune function declining with age, right? Mm-hmm. That's misleading because, I mean, while it's true that your immune system declines in its function from the context of being able to protect you against pathogens and things like that, look at COVID-19, right? That's like as age associated as Alzheimer's disease is, at least in terms of risk of death. So your immune system does decline in that context. At the same time, your immune system becomes hyperactivated in inappropriate ways. So it's not just a global decrease in function, it's a decrease in its normal function with a gain of function in abnormal ways, like autoimmunity, right? So inflammaging, can really be thought of, I think, as that change in the immune system that goes along with aging, both a decline in the ability to respond to infections, cancer surveillance, the normal function the immune system does to maintain health, but at the same time, getting hyperactivation of the immune system in ways that are damaging, right? And so autoimmunity is one example of that. But also you get, one of the things that seems to be happening is you get infiltration of immune cells into tissues, like microglia infiltrating tissues, and then they actually are damaging to those tissues. Senescent cells are another example of inflammaging. So senescent cells accumulate with age. These are cells that leave the cell cycle. So they stop doing what they're supposed to do, but it's worse than that because they don't only leave the cell cycle, but they start giving off all of these inflammatory cytokines. That might actually be part of what recruits the macrophages to come in there and do bad stuff, right? So that's the way I think about inflammaging. And, you know, part of the reason why for a long time I didn't pay much attention to inflammaging and the immune system is because, you know, I got my start as a graduate student in yeast. We talked about my work on Sirtuo earlier. Yeast don't really have an immune system, but we found that mTOR inhibition extended lifespan in yeast and Sirtuo overexpression extended lifespan in yeast. So, you know, my thinking back then was that, you know, how important can that really be when we can see that these conserved factors are in fact, you know, affecting aging in these simple organisms that don't really have the same kind of immune system that, that people and mammals do. But I've become a convert, and in part I've become a convert because, you know, what we're seeing in mice, and I think we see this in people as well, is that many of the declines in function that go on in different tissues are at least strongly associated with a chronic inflammatory environment. And many of the interventions that are most effective turn that down or turn it off. And rapamycin absolutely fits into that. We see this in tissue and tissue after tissue. There's a strong inflammatory increase with age and rapamycin potently shuts it down. Same thing is true with caloric restriction. One of the most robust effects of caloric restriction is turning off this chronic inflammatory signal that goes along with aging. So it's a commonality that the interventions that actually work in mice do have this effect of turning down this chronic inflammatory state. So it's kind of those two things together, right? You can make a plausible mechanistic argument for inflammaging driving functional declines with age, and the interventions that we know work seem to hit that pretty well. The other thing that has solidified, you know, my sort of growing belief that this is important is that if you look at the hallmarks of aging, and that's kind of the classic sort of molecular way that people think about aging biology. If you look at the hallmarks of aging, a bunch of those can cause inflammation, right? So mitochondrial dysfunction can cause inflammation. DNA damage can cause inflammation. Senescent cells, I already talked about, can cause inflammation. So, you know, those can be, that can be something that is, that ties together a lot of these molecular hallmarks of aging that, that, that people in the field have identified over the last couple of decades. So I don't want to suggest that this is the only thing that's driving functional declines and disease risk with aging, but I think it's pretty important. And if I had to pick one thing, I'd say it's probably the most important, or at least maybe the most amenable to targeting therapeutically right now, in terms of having an impact on health and function as we get older.
Very, very interesting. COVID-19, was there any study done or any testing done with rapamycin trying to treat COVID-19 patients?
Yeah, so there have been a couple of clinical trials that, you know, at least got started. I actually don't know what the outcomes of those clinical trials were. But the idea that you know, rapamycin could be beneficial in the context of COVID-19, I think is one that several people have talked about, myself included. I think there are a couple of mechanisms by which rapamycin could be beneficial. One is the aging sort of rejuvenation effect, right? We've talked a little bit about how rapamycin can rejuvenate immune function in mice. Two clinical trials in people suggesting the same thing's probably true. So you could imagine in healthy older people who are less able to fight off COVID-19 once they're infected, if they were to take rapamycin for, you know, say 6 weeks before they get infected, that might allow their immune system to actually keep them from getting very sick. It's not going to protect them against the infection itself, but it might keep them from getting very sick once they've been infected. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you look, there's a study from Joan Manick that they did where they used a different mTOR inhibitor, but it's, you know, probably functioning at least somewhat similarly to rapamycin. So their clinical trial didn't, this is a whole long story, but the short version is they were testing this mTOR inhibitor for its effects on the immune, on rejuvenating immune function in the elderly. They stopped that trial early because they weren't hitting their endpoint. I think in November of 2019, because I think I was at the GSA meeting when Joan told me that they decided to stop the trial early. I think if they had known what was coming in February 2020, they probably would have not stopped that clinical trial. So they went back and they looked at their data, though, for the people who'd been in that clinical trial over the next, I think it was next year. And the people who got the mTOR inhibitor were dramatically protected against coronavirus infection over the next year. That's in the paper. It's really, really interesting and suggestive. So in any case, I think as a potential preventative for severe outcomes from COVID-19, that's one rationale for rapamycin. The other, though, is that, you know, we've heard a lot about the cytokine storm that is a predictor of, you know, death in people who are hospitalized. This is getting back to this whole inflammaging concept that I was talking about. That's essentially, that cytokine storm is in some ways like inflammaging on steroids. And so there have been people who have suggested that rapamycin treatment might be quite beneficial in the context of, you know, the really, really sick people who are hospitalized and keeping them from dying. I don't know if anybody has tested that or not. So I don't know if we know the answer to that. I think right now the data are pretty anecdotal. I'm not aware of any clinical trials that have been published showing benefit or lack of benefit from rapamycin in the context of COVID-19. Kind of the most, other than the study from Joan that I talked about, the other really interesting piece of information that that, you know, is sort of talked about is that that people, there are a whole bunch of people, you know, more than 700 people who are taking rapamycin right now. The sort of anecdotal reports, take it for what it's worth, is that there are no reports of severe outcomes from COVID-19 or death among the patients who are taking rapamycin, where we have some information about them, not just, you know, their own self-reporting. So, you know, that may become clear in the future. I'm sort of hoping that we can start to get some reliable information from these patients who are being, you know, under the care of a physician, prescribed rapamycin for preventative measures and healthy aging. Maybe we can find out whether or not that's actually the case.
Wow, that's very interesting. Well, Matt, we've covered a lot of ground. I think I just want to end with discussing a bit more on good science. And you quoted saying that as scientists, your job is to disprove your model and to figure out where your model is going wrong. And I really love that, because I think you definitely strive for unbiased information and for constantly trying to prove whether your model is wrong and figuring out what is going on at the root of it. Maybe just a few words on like what is good science, because
Sure. So yeah, I mean, I think this idea is really important and unfortunately underappreciated. So, you know, my view, especially in the world of basic science, my view is that, you know, we try to explain biological process based on the data that we've got at hand, right? And we're really good at drawing models. You know, and I talked before about how we like to make these linear models, you know, A interacts with B causes C, right? I think that's really valuable to do that. But I think what we should do when we do experiments is think about our model and identify ways that we can try to break it, right? So the one thing that I think, if I could just get every scientist, every biologist to appreciate this, I think it would be great. Look, your model is wrong. It's wrong. It is an imperfect representation of reality based on the data that we have today. And we know we don't know everything, right? So our goal should be to figure out how is it wrong? Because if we do that, then we make it better. And that's how we should try to design experiments. I'm not perfect at that, but I try to take that approach and to train, you know, the students and postdocs in my lab to try to take that approach. Unfortunately, you know, what I have seen over and over and over again is the opposite approach, where people try to design experiments to prove their model. And there are lots of reasons why that's a mistake. I think the biggest one, though, is that when you do that and you get a result that doesn't fit your expectations, you are then inclined to ignore that result and think it was wrong, right? And I don't think that that's that's not making up data, but the effect is the same, right? Because you are being misled and you are misleading the scientific community by leaving that data out. But it's so easy to do that. If you're sure your model's right and you get an experimental result that is inconsistent with the model, it's so easy just to say, oh, they probably messed up that experiment. Go do it again. I've heard that so many times. I've heard PIs tell their postdocs, oh, just that's wrong. Go do the experiment again, right? So people keep doing it till they get the result they want. That's a real problem. The other reason why I think this is particularly problematic in biomedical research today, though, is that the labs that do that get rewarded, right? It is absolutely the fact that cell science and nature like simple stories where everything fits together. And I'm not blaming the editors. This is really on the reviewers, right? It is much easier to get your paper published in Cell Science and Nature if every piece of data fits a really nice, simple, tight model. And so people who leave out data that don't fit their model are much more likely to publish routinely in high-profile journals. So there's a feedback loop, and their postdocs and graduate students are trained to do science that way, and they get rewarded for it. So there's a feedback loop here that I think is quite damaging. I actually think this is why it takes so long to overturn mistakes in the literature, right? Something gets published, 3 or 4 papers get published in Cell that, you know, this pathway is working this way to do this based on incomplete data and a model that's wrong. It really takes a long time, sometimes decades, to overturn that. I'm just pointing out what I've observed. I don't have any way to fix it because I really think that this reward cycle is what drives that approach to science, right? And, you know, it's unfortunate. And honestly, I'll be honest. Sometimes I wonder if I'm doing, you know, my students and postdocs a disservice by training them to do what I think is rigorous science, because it's harder to be successful in your career when you do rigorous science, in my view. But I think you need integrity too, and you need to feel good about the work you're doing. So I think it's unfortunate, but I'll continue to try to spread the word. And I don't want to suggest that most people do science that way, but here's what I would say. Look, if you look at people who publish 2 or 3 Cell Science Nature papers a year, unless they're working in an area that is super new technology and super hot, generally, those are the people who approach science the way that I suggested, right? And they try to prove their model rather than trying to disprove their model. I think that's just an empirical observation that I've had.
I think that's a brilliant point to bring up. I mean, we were talking about this a bit last time where Karl Popper's epistemology is error correction, like trying to figure out where you're wrong and keep error correcting, right, which is exactly what you're saying. And now I think integrity, especially in science, is key.
I would agree, absolutely. And I guess the thing that I would suggest is you know, it's useful for people when they're reading papers to think about this, right? And I think you can tell sometimes when something fits together just a little bit too nicely, that's probably because something got left out. I mean, biology is complicated and it's rarely clean, you know? And I'm not saying, like, we've published in Science and Nature but those are the rare cases, right? Where something actually, either it was something completely surprising. Actually, you know, most of the time when I've published in the top journals, it's because we found something completely surprising that I wasn't even expecting, right? It's not because we knew the answer going in. It's because, you know, we noticed something that was completely unexpected and recognized that it was unexpected and it turned out to be interesting. So, I think everybody's got to approach it from their own perspective, but, you know, I would encourage my colleagues to think about the way that you approach your science and to think about whether or not, you know, you're suffering from that sort of confirmation bias or you really are, you know, trying to question your model at every step. And again, I'm not at all claiming I'm perfect at it, but I try to take that approach when I'm thinking about the work that's going on in my lab.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Matt. We've covered a lot. Lastly, is there anything you're seeking help on or any closing thoughts on you want to talk about your work or longevity, anything we may have missed?
Yeah, not really. I mean, I don't want to talk about my own work. I guess, you know, the one thing I would come back to is I think this is a really exciting time, as we've sort of already talked about in the field, because there's so much interest, so much enthusiasm, a lot of young people coming into the field on the biotech side, right? So that's really exciting. There's a lot of resources flowing into the field, which is really exciting. So, you know, I think what I would like to see, as I sort of alluded to, is a little bit more of the resources coming into the field going to, you know, really, really important translational geroscience. So, you know, how is there a way that we can accelerate testing of interventions that look promising in the clinical realm? So that's mm-hmm. one, I think, area where we still are really lacking in resources. We just don't have funding mechanisms that can fund important clinical trials right now in geroscience. The other, I think, general thing that I would say, so that's the positive. Like the positive is all of this stuff coming into the field. I think the funding of clinical trials is an important area that's lacking right now. The other area where I would like to encourage people on the basic science side to look is to try to think about studying the biology of aging, and particularly interventions that are outside of the network that everybody else is studying, right? Probably 40% of the field right now is studying these dietary interventions that are nowhere near as effective as caloric restriction or rapamycin, right? I would like to see people really starting to find ways to affect aging that are not incremental, right? So, you know, if you look at the biggest effect on lifespan, we talked about this 65% restriction of calories. That study was published in the 1990s, 1980s maybe, right? Nothing that people are studying today is anywhere close to that. So I think we really need to stop looking under the lamppost and start trying to find other interventions that have big effects on lifespan. I think, you know, maybe the transient reprogramming will get there, you know, the Yamanaka factors, epigenetic reprogramming. But right now, nobody's even shown that that's as good as rapamycin. So I really would like to encourage people to think about strategies to start studying interventions in a way that might allow us to find things with big effect sizes. Probably has to start in invertebrates. You can't really do high throughput screening in mice right now, but we can do high throughput screening in invertebrates. And I think there are technologies that are coming online that should really allow this to happen and start, you know, studying hundreds of thousands of interventions a year rather than a few thousand, which is what the field's doing right now. So that's where I would like to see us go, because I really am concerned that, you know, 99% of the field is studying the same network of genes and proteins and just trying to tweak it in different ways. And there isn't a lot of really, really innovative new approaches to targeting the biology of aging on the preclinical side and on the laboratory side. So so that's where I hope to see us go in the next 5 or 10 years.
Good. That was a great point. Well, thank you so much, Matt. This has been sure. a brilliant discussion. I am even more intrigued about rapamycin now. So thanks so much for your time again.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
If you enjoyed today's episode and learned from it, it would mean a lot if you could show some support and share the podcast with your friends and family. I'd love to spread the science behind aging and longevity to as many people as possible, such that we can all benefit from it and live healthier lives. Additionally, if you enjoy learning about science-backed health optimization, you can check out my newsletter, livelongerworld.substack.com, and my YouTube, which is Live Longer World. You can also support my work by donating on Patreon. I'd like to keep bringing high-quality information to you, and your support certainly helps. Lastly, if you wish to follow me on social media, I am on Twitter at @LiveLongerWorld. I also have an Instagram at @LongevityFuture, where I often post graphics distilling concepts in longevity science, are talking about longevity lifestyle hacks. And that's it for now. Stay in good health and catch you next time.